So thank you so much for being here. This is the last class of our 12-week series of the 5,000-year leap. Woo! We did it. I always feel like a kid in the candy shop on the last day of school, you know? So thank you so much for hanging in there. We did it. The last class under these principles, these 28 principles that we have gone through the last 12 weeks. Our founding fathers embedded in them that they said this was the foundation of a free country. And if this free country were to survive, we would have to maintain these principles upon which the foundation of this free country rests. And it was under these principles that we literally took a 5,000-year leap, putting a man on the moon, just under 200 years of living under the principles found in the Constitution. It unlocked human ingenuity and creativity and prosperity. And it was amazing to see. We have proof is in the pudding. We have seen it throughout history play out. You know, these 28 principles really did change the world because the Constitution became a model for all the nations around the earth at that time. And these principles are the solutions to what is ailing us in our homes, our communities, and with the government. And so this is why we need to know them. We need to study them over and over and memorize them so they come naturally. This is just not a one-time reading of the Bible and then you close it for life. This is not a one-time reading of these principles and then you forget them. This is why it's so important that you get these little bookmarks and you put them in places in your books, in your purses, on your couches, in your cars, and you commit these principles to memory. Because if you do that, these 28 principles will rise up in your hour of need and they will flow naturally from your tongue and you will elevate the level of conversation because you're speaking truth now, not emotions. These principles transcend parties and politics and time and distance because they're based on truth. And they inherently resonate with people. So Al, let's start our slideshow here. I'm just gonna share with you my favorite principles that I use all the time. And just based on these principles alone, I can stand up at a moment's notice at a school board before a state legislator while I'm talking to, you know, I went to a prayer breakfast this morning for the state of Maryland. I sat next to an executive in the governor's office, Wes Moore. She oversees all of the immigrants for the state of Maryland. On the other side of me, I sat next to a county executive, and it's so comfortable for me to sit next to these people because I know, you know why? Because I know these 28 principles of liberty. Let's see the next slide. So, you know, these are my favorite. These are the ones that I use a book all the time. In fact, one of the young mamas, she might be on the call tonight, Tyler Otta, called me this morning because she's going to start teaching the Healing of America seminar. And I'll talk about that in a minute, starting next Thursday. She was confused about a little point. And I said, that is, and I cleared it up by evoking this 21st principle that our founders intended for our problems to be settled at a local level, for the communities to determine the standards of morality, decency, and safety, not Washington, D.C. And then let's just click through these because they, our founders, only wanted Principle 19, only limited and carefully defined powers to be figured out in Washington, D.C. All others were to be retained at the local level in the states. And how do we know that we're going to get good standards if, you know, the local people are determining these standards? Well, the best way to have strong government, whether it be local or national, and the best way to get along with your neighbors and your fellow citizens is to be based in natural law, and which is God's law, the creator's order of things. And that, look, that's not going to happen unless the people around you are steeped in, are morally strong and virtuous, and that they elect those kind of leaders. And people aren't going to remain morally strong and stable and virtuous unless there is religion in their life, which is principle number four. A free society cannot be maintained without religion. And so this is why it's so important. We talked about religious liberties at the prayer breakfast I attended today, why religious liberties are, you know, critical to freedom. So people will have a desire to be good and to elect good leaders and look to godly biblical principles to base their, let's see the next one, to base their laws on. And look, God said, I'm your creator. I know how you're best going to be successful. And so I have given you your rights. Your rights don't come from government. They come from God, number nine. Mm-hmm. And that to protect the rights that God has given, he has revealed certain principles of divine law, which our founders said is found in scripture. This is why we base our laws, our governmental laws, on the divine law found in scripture. And then how do we do all that? Well, we teach these ideas and principles within the four walls of our home, because your country is only as strong as your community, and your community is only as strong as the family. So can you see, if you were to, you know, stand up and speak that way, how, I mean, it would be like a drop the mic moment kind of thing. And this is the power of these principles. This is the foundation upon which our founders said, if we do not maintain this foundation, this free nation cannot survive. So this is why I would implore you to have a personal experience with these principles and just begin to memorize them. Start to memorize one a week or one every other day, and then review them every single day. That's how you will retain them. Repetition is how you memorize something. Reviewing is how you retain it.
This is your weapon when you go to the school board. This is your weapon when you go to town hall meetings. It's you're arming yourself with these principles so that you raise the level of conversation out of the weeds. They want to take you in the weeds and they want you to play whack-a-mole on issues. But if you can raise the level of conversation to something that's principally based, you will be far more effective. It's great to go to the school board meetings. It's great to go to town halls. But if you go with emotion, you're no better than the other side. And so you want to go with results-oriented principles as opposed to fighting rhetoric with rhetoric. That will wear the people out, and it takes the conversation down a lot further. But if you are able to speak these principles, I'm telling you, it resonates with people. It does. It transcends color. It transcends political party, because these principles are eternal.
Beautiful. And so I, would challenge you to now have a personal experience with them. Alan, I've just given you an overview. But these are the solutions that ails America. So what I would like to challenge you right now is, if you could just write two or three sentences about how learning these principles, what they've done for you, you know, how, what kind of experience you've had in this class, just a little 2-3 sentence testimonial. We use these little testimonials when we go before donors so we can show them, you know, some of the results that's transpiring. What have you taught them to your children? Have you taught them to your grandchildren? How are you using them in your personal life, these principles? Are you starting to evoke them when you talk with your neighbor or your cousin or family members or school teachers? And so we would love right now, if you could just write down a little 2 or 3 minute testimonial of how, at least by the end of our class, how attending this 12-week class, learning these principles, has impacted you. And certainly, if you want to start a little study group in your neighborhood now that you've gone through them, everyone get the study manual, fill in the blank, and begin to talk about, you know, how does Principle 28 apply to, you know, our mission moving forward, or 27, or, you know, and so that's a beautiful thing. You really begin to learn something as you give it away. So that's just a little challenge too. Think about, could we ever start a study group in our neighborhood and invite, you know, 6 people over in the evening, or moms, you know, in the morning time. So, okay. So our last two principles tonight, principle 27 and 28. Okay. Yeah. So next week, same time, same place, but we're going to have a new class. It's going to be 16-week series, the Healing of America series. Tyler Otta, she is the state liaison from Virginia. She's a beautiful mother. I think she has 3 children under 5, and she is rising up to this challenge. She's taken the Healing of America seminar several times, the 5,000, all the classes that we offer, she's taken, and she's going to be teaching. I mean, this is really God's, the miracle. So you'll want to get 4 little notebooks, and you can buy them online at the store. I think they're like $12 or $15, maybe they're $20 a piece. I think maybe $50 for all four, something like that. But these workbooks are like my just little treasures. I've just taught from these workbooks for years, and you can write your little notes in them. And the keys are behind in the back of the book. So that will be every Thursday, and it'll take you through June. And then Alan and I are going to take a 6-week break. Next slide. And then we will come back and start teaching on Tuesday evenings, March 5th, The Naked Communist. Remember, this is the title that Cecil B. DeMille, the director of Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments, when he was talking to Cleon Scallon, he said, this is the title you need to use because you need to strip away all the pretense and propaganda and romanticism of communism and show the people, you know, what Marx, the seeds he planted in the 1800s and how it's infiltrating. And this book was written in 1958 and it is as applicable as if it had been written yesterday. And so that will be an 8-week class and that will be on Tuesday evenings. Get that student manual or just buy the book online at Amazon or get the student manual. I believe it's in our store. Hannah can answer that question at the end. Okay, Al, I'm gonna turn it over to you to start our 27th.
Okay, thank you, Jalini.
You're welcome, honey.
All right, 27th principle. The burden of debt is as destructive to freedom as subjugation by conquest. Debt, of course, is simply borrowing against the future. It's saddling future generations with debt, usually from extravagance, as the government has lived beyond its means for a couple generations now. And they basically are spending more money than they are bringing in. Excessive debt greatly curtails, if you think about it in a personal sense, it curtails your own personal freedom. If you've got too much debt, that job that you're passionate about that probably doesn't pay as much as you're making now, but you know, you've got golden handcuffs on, you've got to stay in that job because you've got an incredible amount of debt. So it limits your ability to in your career, it limits your ability to move to other parts of the country. If you want to move somewhere that's, you know, you've got to maintain income so you can pay back those people that you owe money to through credit cards, an exorbitant house mortgage that you might have. You might have a home where you only need 2,500 square feet. You've got 5,000 and you're saddled with this debt, luxury cars, those golden handcuffs. I mean, we see it throughout in our neighborhoods, and we see it in ourselves, actually. And it wasn't until, I believe recently, student loan debt is well over $1 trillion, but credit card debt is right behind it. And so that's a problem. And if our nation is leading this kind of thinking and so forth, it trickles down to the people. And as Ben Franklin said, it says, think what you do when you run in debt. You give to another power over your liberty. And so what were their attitudes toward debt? Well, first of all, they saw frugality as a virtue. They thought it was immoral to pass on debt to future generations. It's okay to have debt from time to time, and you will find it to your advantage sometimes to have debt. But debt becomes the only available means, it also becomes a necessary evil. So that's why the founders thought it was okay to borrow money, particularly during times of war, but to pay it back immediately because they knew that debt was recognized as what it is, and that's evil because it's a form of bondage. And Jefferson said, the maxim of buying nothing without the money in our pockets to pay for it would make our country one of the happiest on earth. Experience during the war proved this. And I think every man will remember that under all the privations, it obliged him to submit to during that period, he slept sounder and awoke happier than he can do now because he's got no debt. So let's talk about this in real terms. So you see this pie chart in front of you. That big old gold or yellow is mandatory spending. And that's because we've got ourselves saddled with these entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those are accounts that have to be paid. And so that's mandatory spending. And then you see what you've got interest. You've got to pay interest on the debt that you're borrowing. But mandatory spending accounts for two-thirds of the federal spending. Look at the defense budget. The defense budget that was recently passed in the National Defense Authorization Act authorized, I think, $856 billion for national defense. And then you've got non-discretionary funding that goes into the Department of Labor, Department of Transportation, Department of Housing and Urban Development, Energy, and so forth, all those agencies. But as you can see there, what's really gone amok is the mandatory spending. So let's see. So in 2020, this is the national debt on an average year. We're bringing in $3,421 billion to the Treasury. But guess what we spent in 2020? This was the COVID year, over $6.5 trillion. That's $3 trillion that's added to the debt. So on average, we're actually adding about between two and two and a half trillion dollars to the deficit every single year. And the interest on that debt is $659 billion. So just think about what I just said in the previous slide. Defense spending is $856.60 billion. And the interest that we have to pay on an annual basis to our creditors is almost as much as the defense budget. And so we just gloss over these issues. The national debt is, it's a tremendous albatross on us. And so we don't get a handle on it. And I've got some ideas that I want to share with you later that will help us get over this. Then we are headed for really serious problems. And that's why we've got an overinflated dollar. Okay, so look at who we owe our money to. I thought this was, the number was greater than this, but China has $1.18 trillion of our debt, and Japan has a little over $3 billion, and the UK down there is $274 billion. These are the folks that control about $7.6 trillion of the debt that we owe out of the $34 trillion. So we're at $34 trillion as a country, and about almost eight is to foreign governments. Okay, so let's see.
Well, so who holds that other debt then?
That's all in bonds. That's all investors who are buying bonds and treasury notes from the government.
So U.S. businesses?
U.S. businesses, individuals, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So 1913, very, very bad year. Who was president in 1913?
Woodrow Wilson.
Creation of the Federal Reserve. We began commingling our nation's finances with the rest of the world, which led us to getting off the gold standard, allowing us to print money for any need, for any reason that the government wanted to spend money for. So you take us off the gold standard, and then you're able to print money. And then you contribute that to the 1936 decision by the Supreme Court, the Butler case, where they changed the definition of general welfare in the Constitution. And they changed that clause to give the government the authority to spend money on anything they deem necessary. Then you had the 16th Amendment that was passed in 1913. This allowed the Congress to go right around the states to directly tax the people. Before the 16th Amendment, if it was all based on how many folks you sat in the House of Representatives. So if California had 8% or 10% of the representation in the House, then they were responsible for 8 to 10% of the federal budget. And they could come up with that money any way they wanted to. They could tax the people, they could sell oil, they could sell timber, whatever they needed to do to pay that, their obligation. That's how taxes were paid. And they did it through excise taxes on foreign imports and so forth. And that was enough money to run the government because the government was small. When they passed the 16th Amendment, that allowed them to go right around the states and directly into the pockets of the people. When they first implemented the 16th Amendment, which you'll learn when you take the Healing of America seminars, they only said they would cap it at 1%. And now we see where it is today. Then you've got the 17th Amendment, which violates the separation of powers and that whole notion of checks and balances. So the Senate was to ask two questions of the House when legislation came out of the House. Number one, does it infringe on the rights of the people? Because the states were there to protect the people. They were appointed by the state legislature. So the senators were responsible to their home states for their votes in Congress throughout that week. So the first question was, Does it infringe on the rights of the people that I'm representing? And number two, can we afford it? Social Security was passed in 1936. If it wasn't for the 17th Amendment, this would have never happened because, first of all, Social Security infringes, it sounds great on the surface, but it infringes on the rights of the people because that money automatically comes out of your paycheck and payroll taxes. You have no say over that. It comes right out of your paycheck. So you're not keeping what you earn. And then secondarily, we can't afford it. We can't afford it because the states would have to have paid for it. But when you've got the 16th Amendment and the 17th Amendment, then you can go around, you can tax the people directly, and then you don't have to worry about that senator who's on the wall protecting the rights and the freedoms of the individuals. And then, as I indicated, you've got the Butler case of 1936.
Right. So that 16th Amendment grew the federal budget. So they now kind of open the door to socialism, and all these programs in the federal government will take care of you because now their coffers were getting bigger because they were taxing you directly and have instead of having to go to the state.
Right. That's exactly right. Because how do you stay in office? You take from those who have and you give it to those who have not. So here's some more reasons why we're in the mess we're in. The Great Depression, we've talked about it. We don't let any emergency go to waste. So all branches of the federal government use that climate of the emergency of the Depression to overstep their constitutional authority. And then the people were induced to believe that violations of the constitutional principles would provide a shortcut to economic prosperity. And so they were given the promise that they would be lifted out of the Depression if they allowed the government to spend the way they wanted to, hence the 1936 Supreme Court decision on the Butler case. They thought we can spend our way out of the Depression as opposed to tightening our belts and staying on the gold standard and letting things right themselves naturally. Then you've got this false premise that spending vast amounts of borrowed money would lead to prosperity. That hasn't really worked for us at all, not even in the least bit. And then you look at the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate was actually, after all of that spending, it was higher in 1938 than compared to 1932. And so if it wasn't for World War II, that really bailed out the nation and put people back to work. It was World War II. Okay, so let's talk about some things to solve the problem. So first of all, in terms of restoring the Constitution, this is right out of Seminar 4.
Repealing of America.
Repeal the 17th Amendment to restore that check and balance. You want the senators beholden to their states. You elect them the first time, special interest keeps them in office. You elect them the first time through the legislature, but then because the people aren't picking their senators through the legislature, they're being voted on by the majority of the people. You get elected by the people the first time, but once you get into office, then you become beholden to everybody that contributes to your campaign because you are not going to raise enough money within the state that you live to stay in office. So you have to raise it from Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Big Pharma. All these different special interests now own you because you're raising money from them so you can stay in office. And the best way to stay in office, as we indicated, is to bring the goodies back home, which blows up our deficit.
So before that, before 1913, the senators were elected by their state legislature. And if they voted in DC for something that the state legislature did not approve of, they could pull them from office.
That is correct. Yes. And the second thing you want to do these in order. First, repeal the 17th Amendment, restore the checks and balances, and then repeal the 16th Amendment, thereby cutting off the money supply to the federal government, which would restore veto power of the states through their senator. And then you would enact legislation to repeal the Federal Reserve. You do those three things and you'll put us, as Dr. Skousen said, back on economic footing within 3 to 5 years. If you do these three things in order, you will put us back on firmer footing in 3 to 5 years. Okay, Julie.
Okay, wow. That was good. You got me all, I love solutions. You get me all riled up here. All right, principle 28, one of my most favorite war cries from the champions of the camp, remember that term in the Old Testament, was from these mighty men of valor. You study about them in the book of Joshua or Gideon's army or King David's 37 strongest men that were at the front of the line there. And I also like to say there's women of valor too, but the mighty men of valor is the terminology they used for the best fighters in the camp. And they're wise women. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. But these men were known for their strength and their courage and passion, the strength of mind and spirit. And when they encountered danger, it was with firmness. And this, you know, what really set these mighty men of valor apart in the Old Testament wasn't their athleticism, and they were strong. It said they could wield a sword with the right and the left hand, but it was that they all had firm relationships with God. Okay. I just love this concept of these mighty men of valor. It just pricked my imagination when I read about them in the Old Testament. Now, you know, they're known for their bravery. If you think of today, the opposite of bravery is fear and even apathy. And it seems like we've got an epidemic of fear and apathy. And we saw that particularly during the lockdowns of COVID, where we were just so willing to just be good little soldiers and do exactly what we were told. When you live with these 28 principles written deeply in your heart, you are convicted, meaning that you are unafraid, and you will be driven to want to be a doer, to be a mighty man and woman of valor. That you won't be at ease in Zion, as it talks about in the book of Amos in the Old Testament. You won't say, oh yeah, it's all good, all is well. You won't want to stick your head in the sand and just worry about going to the shopping or to a movie. You'll be like that little young David who said, is there not a cause worth fighting for? Come on, this is our cause. And our founding fathers understood principle 28 was their cause, that the United States has a manifest destiny to be an example and a blessing to the entire human race, that it was evident, it was clear, it was obvious to them that God's hand was in the establishment of this first free modern society, free government in modern times, and that he was not going to allow it to collapse into oblivion, but we all had our part in order to, you know, be that light on the hill and be a part of this manifest destiny to be an example to the world. All historians agree that the most singular and important feature of the settlers of America was their overpowering sense of mission, mm-hmm. of conviction that they were taking part of this unfolding of a manifest destiny of divine, a design which would shower blessings on all mankind. Right. This is what drove our founding fathers and mothers. And historian John Fiske, who was born during the Civil War time in 1842, he was an American philosopher and a historian from Connecticut. I love this quote. This is what our founding fathers felt they were. They believed that they were doing, he said, a wonderful thing. They felt themselves to be instruments in accomplishing a kind of manifest destiny. Their exodus from Europe was that of a chosen people who were at length to lay the everlasting foundation of God's kingdom upon earth. This steadfast faith in an unseen ruler and guide was to them a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. It was a great moral value. It gave them clearness of purpose and concentration of strength and contributed towards making them like the children of Israel. Isn't that interesting? A people of indestructible vitality and aggressive energy. So do you see what he's saying here? They considered themselves to be like a part of the remnant of the house of Israel. And, you know, if they would covenant with God, they would receive the same protections under that Abrahamic covenant, right?
Oh, that's in Deuteronomy chapter 30.
Yeah. That said, look, God, if you would turn to me and make covenants with me and be one nation under God, I will promise you prosperity and protection and a promised land. And that's what the founders felt they were, that they were entitled to that umbrella of protection mm-hmm. for this new land as long as they were one nation under God. They were in a covenantal relationship with God. And I think this is why they were able to just be fearless and do what they did. And so this sense of manifest destiny really has been continued from this time forward, and nearly all inaugural addresses from presidents have, you know, have mentioned this idea. And it was extremely important, though, it tells us in our book, to distinguish between this sense of mission and a spirit of perverted chauvinism they talk about, associated with the idea of racial superiority. And the former is a call to exemplary leadership and service. The latter is an arrogant presumption of a self-appointed role to conquer and rule. And this distinction between the two was readily perceived in the writings of John Adams here when he said, and he was our second president of the United States, "I always considered the settlement of America with reverence and wonder as the opening of a grand scene and a design in Providence for the illumination of the ignorant and the emancipation of the slavish part of mankind all over the earth." Thomas Jefferson said, as he looked upon the development of freedom under the Constitution, he said it was the world's best hope. And he wrote to John Dickinson, another founding father, in 1801. He said, "That which has been accomplished in the United States will be a standing monument, an example for the aim and imitation of the people of other countries." Do you understand that the founders knew what was going on here? This was way bigger and greater than them. And it was not uncommon for the founders to stress the responsibility that they felt had been placed upon them. It was a mighty task that they had performed. And John Adams would write this about the Constitution. He said, "The people of America have now the best opportunity and the greatest trust in their hands that Providence ever committed to so small a number," about 3 million at that time in the colonies when they became a country. And then 10 years later or so, the Constitution was written. And then Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, who was the Secretary of Treasury under George Washington, had this to say: "It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country by that their conduct and example to decide the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good governments from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their politics." What does it say there? Their politics,
like, political.
Their political, what does that say? Political constitutions on accident and force, right? And so he would go on to say, Hamilton, that if the people of the United States fail in this mission, it would operate to the general misfortune of mankind. And John Adams said that he would consider failure of this country, if the people abandon the freedom gained by the adoption of the Constitution, it would be treason against the hopes of the world. I mean, like, betraying the world if we do not make, you know, these principles under the Constitution work. Because these founders knew these principles, this Constitution was struck off by the divine hand of Providence. They felt that in the 4 months when they went back and forth in that hot room in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And then John Jay also talks about, he was our first Supreme Court justice, appointed in 1789, nominated by George Washington. He too chimes in here in the back of the book and considers America to be a providential blessing for the entire world. And so as we've studied, we can go to the full screen, as we've studied these 28 principles of freedom that our founding father said must be understood. Owen James Madison, we love this. This is one of our favorite ones. He said he was the father of the Constitution. "Happily for America, happily we trust for the whole human race, they pursued a new and more noble course. They accomplished a revolution which has no parallel in the annals of human history. They reared the fabrics of governments which have no model on the face of the globe. They formed the design of a great confederacy, which it is incumbent on their successors to improve and perpetuate." perpetuate. It's almost like his voice is being heard from the grave. He is talking to you and I here this evening. He said that these principles must be studied and understood so that we can now perpetuate them on into our future and into our children and grandchildren's future. For those who desire peace, prosperity, and freedom, we need to know these principles so that we can defend them and keep them going for future generations. And that is on your shoulders. It is on mine. It is on yours. Adherence to these beliefs brought about more progress than was experienced in the previous 5,000 years in history. This is the solution to healing of our families, our schools, our states, our constitution, and our country. These principles are the foundation of a free nation if we hope for it to survive. So it cannot be a one-time study, is what I'm saying. And you, my friends, are the modern mighty men and women of valor. Now you might think, there sure doesn't seem to be a lot of us, you know, but God has always worked with small means and small numbers. So we can take heart. That's his battle strategy is small numbers. It reminds me of the wise woman in 2 Samuel chapter 20 through 19. Do you remember her where she summoned the general of King David's army, of the army of Israel, because they were going to come in and destroy this woman's city. I forget what the name of the city was, because there was a bad dude hanging out there. His name was Sheba. And he had threatened King David's life. And so the general was going after him and he was hiding out in this town. And the woman, she says, a wise woman, we don't even know her name. She just called a wise woman, called out from the city. And she summons the general. And she said, listen, please tell Joab was the general. Tell him to come here so that I can speak with him. And I don't know if the whole city rallied around and appointed her to be the spokesperson. Let's see the next slide. But when Joab came, she said, I am a peaceable and faithful woman. I am a mother in Israel. She evoked her motherhood. Why are you going to destroy my city, my children, my grandchildren? And then they have this interesting conversation in Samuel, 2 Samuel. And he said, look, this guy is going to kill the king. We got to get rid of him. And if it means destroying your city, that's what we're going to do. So she said, please hold on. We will go back. We will, the little citizens in my town will gather together and we will find him. We will root this evil out of our town. We will cut his head off. Let's see the picture again. And we will throw his head over the wall so he will know he's dead. And sure enough, that courageous woman, those people in that town did what it took to stand up and protect that city, their children, their grandchildren. And they cast out those things that were bringing their families and their cities and town harm. And I love this example of this mighty woman of valor, this wise unknown woman, her willingness to stand up and summons and then rally the townspeople and root out the evil that was going to be the means of the destruction of their family. And so, you know, I love stories like that because it speaks to me, I am a mother in Israel, so to speak, and I am on that wall defending my children, mother and father together. And so how in the world how do we get to be these modern men and women of valor? Well, you should be able to teach a little sermonette on this. We bring God into our life. We don't look to the government to tell us what to do or to solve our problems. We're on our knees. We take our children, our grandchildren to God. Are we praying daily? Are we in the Word of God? Are we teaching these things, principles to the people we love the most? Look, you get an A+ for number 3. You are here tonight. So we know you're doing this. You're studying these principles of liberty, the Constitution, from the viewpoint of the founding fathers. And then you get on your knees and you ask God, what can I do? What can be my part of rooting out the evil in the world to justify the heavens to intervene and heal this land? Let's see the next slide. So 1 year ago, at this time, we were getting ready. We're making our little posters for tomorrow. And we are doing that now tonight. We're making our posters. We'll probably do it in the morning. Tomorrow is the March for Life. And this is what this little mama is doing. And we'll be taking two of our daughters. Last year, I took some mothers and my little girl. And we went downtown once a year. There's a March for Life, for standing for the unborn. And let's see the next slide. We made our little posters, and Jesus, the TV Jesus, he said, I'm not Jesus. I'm just the TV Jesus from The Chosen, was one of the speakers. And there was several hundreds of thousands of people there standing for the unborn. And it was powerful. And so I've convinced him he's coming tomorrow. And there'll be hundreds of thousands of people, mostly not from Washington, D.C., that will be coming in from all around the world. And what that does to be there, the Spirit of God is palpable. And you might think, what is some little march that, and I can guarantee you, it will not be covered in the Washington Post. It will not be covered on the news in Washington, D.C. They don't like anyone to know that this rally goes on once a year. President Trump was the only president in the history of this country that has ever attended this March for Life. That's one of the reasons I like him. And so tomorrow, you know, that is what God has put on our heart when we say, do something. Good night. God bless. And when we see you next, it'll be a little warmer, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Take care, everyone.